planetary.com in the Planetary Society store, or a 200-point iTelescope.net account. iTelescope is the worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes. That account will get you a couple hundred dollars. You can donate it to a school or a nonprofit as well. We'll help you out with that if you're the winner.
Excellent. All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what would your eccentricity be? Go out and look, and I'm so eccentric, man. Thank you, and good night.
Clearly, my eccentricity is every week talking with the chief scientist of Bruce Betts. I suppose you are the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, Bruce Betts, here on What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its old and new but never blue members. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan, Ad Astra.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few choice words about the current state of the Democratic Party. And those words are, it ain't pretty. Those of you with weak stomachs would best be advised to avert your eyes. And please, keep all children behind closed doors for the next couple of months. Because watching the Democrats is scarier than finding scorpions in your underwear. If their shenanigans were up on the big screen, it would qualify as a horror movie. Not even sure if the word party should apply here anymore. It certainly doesn't fit in terms of celebration. There's no frolicking or joviality. And if you mean party in terms of a gathering of like-minded individuals, that too leaves quite a bit to be desired. More like a loose collection of misfits who cluster together for the sole purpose of claiming not to like President Donald Trump. And that's about it. They don't stand for anything, not even the national anthem. You can't even accuse Democrats of being afraid of their own shadow because at this point they don't actually cast one. Besides, it's hard to see your shadow when your head's so far up your butt you can tickle your spleen with your elbow. Not only aren't they in the game, they don't even know that one is being played. The Republicans attack with torches and pitchforks, and the Democratic response is to introduce legislation to reform pitchfork safety standards. You should put corks in those. Phosphorescent for nighttime visibility. And if you insist on carrying torches, they need to be flame resistant, at least 2 inches long. Should come in for about $12 a piece. I know a guy who can knock them out for $6. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
Non-Human Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Farmstar Pizza, local seasonal and organic delights at Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts, and they have vegan and gluten-free offerings, as well as craft beer and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week for lunch, and for dinner with live music every Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday evenings. Located in Chico at 2359 The Esplanade, you can also find Farmstar Pizza on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. And we're made possible by the Zeppelin Works, specializing in Volkswagen, BMW, Porsche, Audi, Volvo, and Mercedes since 1981. The Zeppelin Works is a full-service repair facility providing technical expertise for any European automotive problem or maintenance. More information can be found by calling 893-0757 or at zeppelinworks.com. This is KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Non-Human Radio. And welcome to the July 11th, 2018 episode of Non-Human Radio, where we talk animal rights and veganism almost every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. here on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico and streaming online at kzfr.org. And also there's a nifty app that you can download to listen to this show and all our shows on your smartphone. With me, as usual, is co-host Danny Toms. Please, Danny, give our listeners a summary of what they'll be hearing in the next half hour or so.
What do Starbucks, McDonald's, and Chico State all have in common? All of them have joined in on the straw ban challenge. We'll talk about two recent articles covering the issue and share a better way to show you care about plastic pollution. As a hint, fishing nets are made from plastic. We'll finish up with a recent article from Newsweek titled, Three Poachers Eaten by Lions After Breaking Into Game Reserve to Hunt Rhinos. It may be a little okay to feel happy about that. Take it away, Jeannie.
Thanks, Danny. Starbucks has announced that it plans to eliminate plastic straws from its 28,000 stores worldwide by the year 2020. The company will broaden the manufacture and use of what some have dubbed the adult sippy cup, which is a plastic strawless lid that will come to replace single-use plastic straws that now inundate its coffee shops. The company says the move, when fully implemented, could mean a billion fewer plastic straws across its stores each year. The change is part of Starbucks' $10 million investment in creating recyclable and compostable cups around the world. The strawless lid has already been in use at many of the company's stores for certain kinds of cold drinks, like its cold foam and draft nitro drinks that come out of pressurized nitrogen kegs and require very little assistance from the barista. Unlike straws, the new sippy cup lid can be recycled, the company said. Other chains are also experimenting with getting rid of straws. In June, McDonald's announced that it would start phasing out plastic straws at about 1,300 restaurants in the United Kingdom and Ireland. And in April of this year, Chico State became the first California State University campus to eliminate plastic straws. Chico State's dining services manager estimated that about 130,000 plastic straws are used every academic year. In support of the student-led sustainability efforts, Associated Students Dining at Chico State seized the opportunity to eliminate plastic straws on campus. This was reported in an Orion campus newspaper article. Anyone can use their own reusable drink containers at Chico State for coffee or soft drinks and get a 20-cent discount. And unlike at Starbucks, paper straws will be available upon request on campus. And just a heads up, because the show is about veganism, those recyclable paper straws are actually coated with beeswax. Apparently, that makes them more durable. I was quite surprised at that.
Yeah, and then like, would that scale up to billions of straws? I mean, how much beeswax is there?
Oh, yeah. No, it probably would. As with so many sustainability measures, like grass-fed beef or hormone-free dairy cows, the whole organic movement, it doesn't, yields are less.
Yeah.
So, anyway, I just think that was interesting.
You've got some interesting data on where this straw campaign came from.
Yeah, it's interesting too because activists and news media often use a figure that Americans use 500 million plastic straws every day, and that sounds like a really significant number. But it turns out that the source of that number, that 500 million straws per day, turns out to be from a survey conducted by a 9-year-old. The statistic is often posted on National Park Service websites. But when questioned in January of this year by a report from a reporter from the website Reason.com, in an article it was there's a proposed California legislation to put a fine on plastic straws. So the article was about that. But they did some digging into this 500 million plastic straws per day statistic. And then it was found that the National Park Service got this number from a recycling company called EcoCycle. So then the reporter went to EcoCycle, and they found that EcoCycle was not able, they hadn't done their own research. They said that instead it was relying on research by a young man who arrived at the 500 million straws a day figure from phone surveys he conducted on straw manufacturers back in 2011 when he was just 9 years old. And so I just...
My cousin's brother's uncle's nine-year-old kid said we use a lot of straws, and now it's on the...
It's amazing, right? It goes to show, like, we want to do the right thing, and we want to grasp at these facts and statistics that support these actions that we can take.
Right.
And yet we can throw so many statistics and numbers about the suffering and the death that goes on in the animal industry, and those kind of like wash over people.
Right.
Right. Unless you're ready to take in that fact, that statistic, and make it your own, it'll just wash right over you. But something like this, which travels around much like a meme does, it just works.
Yeah,
mischief, you know, in some ways, or not mischief, but kind of misguided actions.
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple of comments. I mean, people might be surprised that as both a animal rights show and reasonably environmentally friendly people, that we're not actually super impressed by this study or this notion of the straws being banned, because as we'll get into it, it doesn't amount to much. So we really try to be reasonably fact-based when we can. Also, you know, there are issues around this in regards to people with disabilities.
Yes,
and
definitely.
I am not a disabilities rights activist. It's a very nuanced conversation. It also kind of relates to, the California, I think, some cities not giving you a glass of water upon request. So, you know, in terms of using less is good for the environment. I think that's a good thing. I don't use a straw anyway. Many people don't. I think there's got to be a solution. You know, some people with certain disabilities don't have the ability to ask for a straw. But I'm sure there's a sweet spot in the middle, rather than saying we're going to just needlessly use up all these straws for no reason. I feel like where this came from is a couple months ago, there was, videos going around on Facebook about a turtle with a bunch of straws sticking out of it. And so it's interesting from both an animal rights strategy point of view is that, you know, memes and marketing and public relations is what drives things. Numbers, statistics, appeals to empathy, picture's worth 1,000 words.
Absolutely.
And, maybe we need, unless it's a picture people won't look at. So it's a complicated situation.
And certainly people don't want to look at intense undercover video from slaughterhouses. So you're listening to Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM. Listener-supported community radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino and Danny Toms. So what's the other... let's shed some more light on this straw issue for us, please.
Yeah, Jeannie has set up a great show here of cohesive articles. In March 2018, Laura Parker wrote an investigative piece for National Geographic on the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch is the world's largest collection of floating trash and the most famous. It lies between Hawaii and California, way out there in the ocean, and is often described as larger than Texas. Even though it contains not a single square foot of surface on which to sand, and it cannot be seen from space as is often claimed. Microplastics, which are, tiny microscopic plastics, make up 94% of an estimated 1.8 trillion pieces of plastic in the patch, but that only amounts to 8% of the total tonnage, because a piece is, depends how big the piece is.
Right. I think what they do is, they take their plastic sample, and then they break that up into individual pieces.
Right.
And on any given sample, we have a lot of it, 94% is like small pieces.
And I think the distinction is important because, big pieces kill animals, tiny pieces get eaten by animals and pass up the food chain and eventually kill some other animal or enter back into the human food chain. So that's reasons why they're quantifying the sizes of these things. But as it turns out, of the 79,000 metric tons of plastic in the patch, most of it is abandoned fishing gear. It's not plastic bottles or packaging, as headlines often proclaim. Or straws. The Great Pacific Garbage Patch is not made up of straws. So that goes back to, the previous article. We certainly support not wasting straws, but also it's a bit of a feel-good effort. A comprehensive new study published in Scientific Reports concluded that the 79,000 metric tons of waste was 4 to 16 times larger than had been previously estimated for the patch. The study found that fishing nets account for 46% of the trash, with the majority of the remainder composed of other fishing industry gear, including ropes, oyster spacers, eel traps, crates, and baskets. Scientists estimate that 20% of the debris is from the 2011 Japanese tsunami.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, what a devastating thing that was, right? And, yeah, the ocean is not a giant garbage can. It doesn't just magically disappear. The study's lead, Arthur Lawrence Labertan, who is an oceanographer with the group Ocean Cleanup, says the research team was looking to assess the larger pieces. They knew there would be a lot of fishing gear, but discovering that 46% of the waste was fishing gear was unexpected. Initially, they thought fishing gear would be more in the 20% range because that's the accepted number for marine debris globally, which is sort of 20% from fishing sources and 80% from land.
Yeah, and who knows what, I didn't dig into what the source of that percentage was, but it could have come from some 2011 research that was done at just a very preliminary level.
Or right? Self-reporting by fishermen, you know, which have a bias. I would hazard a guess that most fishermen don't bring a lot of trash back from their ocean voyages, you know? Cost them money in various ways. George Leonard, the chief scientist at the Ocean Conservancy, said that, quote, "The interesting piece is that at least half of what they're finding is not consumer plastics, which are central to much of the current debate, but fishing gear. This study is confirmation that we know abandoned and lost gear is an important source of mortality for a whole host of animals, and we need to broaden the plastic conversation to make sure we solve this wedge of the problem." As we talked about earlier, it's marketing and what catches people's attention, and nobody is talking about banning fishing gear or reducing fishing gear.
Yeah, so for the person who's like, oh yeah, we should not take that straw. That's like a good step. That's I'm all for that. But I think that if that's I think you need to look at your intentions and your values in making that choice and saying, what else is part of this picture? And here we're telling you part of this picture, a bigger part of this picture is the fishing industry.
Right. Let that be a consciousness raising moment and then move from that to more applicable solutions or problems. Moving on here, ghost nets, a term coined to describe purposely discarded or accidentally lost netting, drift through the ocean, entangling whales, seals, and turtles. An estimated 100,000 marine animals are strangled, suffocated, or injured by these plastics every year. The Ghost Fishing Foundation describes ghost fishing as what fishing gear does when it has been lost, dumped, or abandoned. Imagine a fishing net that gets snagged on a reef or a wreck and gets detached from the fishing vessel. The fishing vessel. Nets, long lines, fish traps, or any of the man-made contraptions that catch fish are considered capable of ghost fishing when unattended and without any profiting from the catches. They are already affecting already depleted commercial fish stocks. Caught fish die. They attract scavengers, which will get caught in that same net in sort of a vicious cycle, much sort of like tar pits have throughout history. The issue of ghost fishing was first brought to the attention of the world at the 16th session of the FAO Committee on Fisheries in April 1985. That's a long time ago.
This is not a new issue.
Yeah.
This is something I reported on this for the Animals Voice magazine back in 1988.
Wow.
So this issue of these ghost nets, drifting walls of death, is not new, and yet it's taken 30 years for the general public to even begin to notice these.
There's a couple of issues. Like, you know, these are not butterfly nets. These are miles and miles long. I mean, it's hard to conceive of how big they are because you can't even see them unless they're like in the ocean and you're diving around some of these things. And, you know, and as human beings, out of sight, out of mind, most people think very little about the impacts of fishing on the nets, on the bycatch, on the diesel pouring into the ocean and the oil leaks and the garbage, the slavery, all the horrible things going out on the high seas, because it's just so far removed from what you get in the supermarket. So this lost fishing gear, the ghost gear, is among one of the greatest killers in our oceans, and not just because of their numbers. As I just kind of said, hundreds of kilometers of nets and lines get lost every year. And because these things are, you know, made to be durable in the ocean, they will continue capturing and killing random animals as they float around for hundreds of years. It's impossible to know.
When I think about these drift nets, because I'm a Star Trek fan, I think of there is a Star Trek episode where it's called the Doomsday Device, and it's a planet-swallowing a weapon that has has taken a life of its own, and it roams around the universe, swallowing up ships and planets. And that's what I think of these fishing nets as.
Right. I mean, and you could think of it in the same way as you think of any dangerous item, you know, weapons or whatever that you're going to leave lying, or toxic waste dumps, stuff that we are leaving around for the future that isn't just going to disappear, you know. So, yeah, it's a big deal. And I wish, you know, we have lots of the straw campaign, you know, not knocking it, but like, where's the public outrage and where are the campaigns to go clean up this garbage? You know, let's stop the fishing lines, first of all, and monitor some of these ghost lines. And where's the international outrage to go clean up this giant patch of garbage? It's just, well, it's not my garbage. It's not mine. It's international waters. Somebody else's problem, you know.
That seems to be the general trend in the industry. I did some research, and our own U.S. federal agency, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has a marine debris program, and it seems to be focused more on cleaning up derelict ships and shore cleanups, and not so much at these drift nets. But there are certainly nonprofits that are focused on that. Sea Shepherd has picked up a couple of campaigns. They have a big campaign in our own Gulf of California, which is mostly in Mexico, where there are lots of fishing debris that's killing a special porpoise called the vaquita. It's a tiny, very special little marine mammal. So they have a campaign to work with fishermen in the area, as well as outside volunteers to come in and clean those up. The Bloomberg website had a nice editorial by a fellow named Adam Minter, who's the author of a book called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the $1 billion Trash Trade. That was actually a very good book. He has a great point to make, and I'll read what his editorial said. Since the early 1990s, there's been widespread agreement on at least one solution to drift nets, lost drift nets, a system to mark commercial fishing gear so that a person or company that bought the fishing net, the netting, can be held accountable when it's abandoned. Countries belonging to the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization, that's what the FAO is, have even agreed on guidelines for that process. But while rich countries should be able to meet such standards with ease, in the developing world, where waste management is largely informal, the problem is much harder. In Indonesia, for example, one study concluded that fishermen have little incentive to bring someone else's net to a disposal point unless they're getting paid to do so. We in the United States take all our infrastructure for granted.
Yeah.
I think that an enlightening visit that anybody, at least in Butte County, can do, because our dump is right here, is to go visit the dump and see the mountain of trash that our region produces.
I think I was dismayed at like 8 years old when I realized garbage didn't just magically disappear at the curb. They bury it down the, you know, a couple miles away in a valley. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? That's crazy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, growing up in LA, I had no idea where my trash went.
Right.
It would have been very informative, much more informative, by the way, for a kid to go to the dump than to go to the dairy and see about the beauty of milk. Right.
Right.
What he suggests is that all the energy, all this anti-straw energy, could be used to put pressure on developing systems for lesser developed countries to recover these fishing nets. And as an example, he says in 1990, after years of consumer pressure, the world's three largest tuna companies agreed to stop intentionally netting dolphins. Soon after, they introduced dolphin safe certification labeling, and tuna related dolphin deaths declined. A similar campaign to pressure global seafood companies to adopt gear marking practices and to help developing regions pay for them could have an even more profound impact. So that's the kind of thing. Obviously, I think that the best corollary behavior to go with the straw ban campaign is to reduce or eliminate your fish consumption.
Yeah.
But something like this type of program to at least help developing countries do their fishing industry better.
Yeah, and it's a hard program because it has to be global. It has to be every country, because if everybody doesn't participate, the guy that doesn't participate is going to sell his fish for cheaper.
Yep.
And it will be bought first, and he's incentivized not to participate. So,
you've been listening to to Animal News on Non-Human Radio on KZFR 90.1 FM, listener-supported community radio. What's next, Danny?
Next, you want me to take this story, Jeannie?
Oh, why don't you go ahead?
All right. Two in a row. Special. Last week, Newsweek magazine reported that a pride of lions ate a group of poachers who broke into a game reserve in South Africa to hunt rhinoceroses.
You read that too fast. A pride of lions ate a group of poachers. We want to hear that.
Yes. Three men were believed to have been eaten alive by the lions sometime between Sunday night and Monday morning after they entered the Sibuya Game Reserve in Kenton-on-Sea in South Africa to hunt rhinos. You know, if you ever want to see colonialism in a sentence, South Africa with something named at the very obviously English Kenton-on-Sea name. After the incident, authorities recovered the remains of the individuals, which was mostly three pairs of shoes, wire cutters, high-powered hunting rifles with silencers, and a kind of axe that poachers use to remove rhino horns. Big cats don't really like shoes. Nick Fox, the park's owner, told Newsweek that the only body part we found was one skull and one bit of pelvis. Everything else was completely gone. There was so little left that they didn't know exactly how many people were killed. We suspect three because we found three sets of shoes and three sets of gloves. Fox also revealed that rhino poaching groups usually consist of three people. Although Fox admits the incident was sad, he also noted that it should send a message to other poachers who risk their lives to hunt game in his reserve. On Monday morning, one of Sibuya's anti-poaching dogs gave her handler a warning that something was wrong, and soon the handler heard a commotion from the lions, but didn't investigate, as that behavior was not unusual. This sounds a bit odd, so hopefully somebody follows up with the handler. One day later, one of the rangers' reserves came upon the remains of the poachers. After alerting the police, the staffers decided to continue their investigation the next morning as it was getting dark. On Wednesday, Sibuya employees and police found the poachers' gear scattered throughout the thick bushes. Sibuya is one of the most popular game reserves in the South African province of Eastern Cape. The facility boasts 30 square miles of wildlife and contains Africa's big five game animals, lions, rhinos, elephants, buffaloes, and leopards.
But I did go to the Sibuya Game Reserve website, and at least they're not advertising hunting exhibitions. It's right. All birding and safari, you know, visual
right.
Safaris and treks and things like that.
Cool. Due to its prominence and collection of animals, the park has faced multiple break-ins by poachers in recent years. In 2016, three rhinos were shot dead by poachers who broke into the reserves to cut off their horns. On Friday, the game reserve owner told Newsweek that the reserve had received a large number of calls from people concerned about the fate of the lions. Fox said that they would not be killed and that the status quo will continue. So, I mean, I have a few comments on this. You know, in the animal rights circles, this gets a lot of cheers, a little bit of revenge. But that also draws out a lot of people saying, you know, you vegans have no compassion and you're cheering the death of these people. Yeah. It's complicated is all I can say. You know, you also have to consider what is your quality of life and your socioeconomic status if your way to make a buck has to be to break into a dangerous game reserve and, you know, kill rhinoceros. They possibly don't have better choices. On the other hand, it's a game reserve. They know that. They know it's illegal. And even worse, it's really getting horns for, you know, the Asian horn trade market of homeopathic, you know, sort of horn medicine nonsense. So it's complicated, but at least, you know, the lions came out on top this time.
And I think that, you know, from the vegan perspective, we can find some sense of fair play in this kind of event. And to be criticized for that would, from someone who eats meat, is to say,
right.
Well, look at your own behavior and what you accept without question, which is being a part of a very cruel system.
Yeah.
For the sake of meat, eggs, and dairy.
I mean, consumerism in general is driving lots of cruelty and pain and suffering, both for these rhino horns or for meat and dairy, you know.
So,
yeah.
And they, as a follow-up, the Sibuya owner of that game reserve said that the lions seem to be not behaving any differently, despite having tasted flesh, tasted human flesh. They seem to be behaving the same way towards the safari vehicles and trekkers there.
Right. I think it said the distinction is, you know, the vehicles are not people, and people are obviously. This is another reason: stay in your vehicle on safari, please.
Yes, please do. All right. Well, we have come to the end of the show, and now it's the time for the Chico Animal Rights Calendar of Events. We have just a few events coming up. On July 28th is the Chico Vegan Potluck, hosted by Chico Vegan Meetup. That will be on Saturday, July 28th. That's the fourth Saturday of the month, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Chico Public Library. And the optional theme is to be determined still. But you can find potluck details and the schedule for the rest of the year at chicovegan.com. And on Thursday, July 26th, which is the last Thursday of the month, the Plant-Based Chico will be holding their monthly meeting at the Chico Guild Hall at 2775 Nord Avenue in Chico. And they will be sharing tips and tricks on how to be a happy, healthy, whole foods, plant-based vegan who consumes no added salt, oil, or sugar. It's a very healthy and health-restoring way to eat. And that is a free event open to the public. And for more information, check out the Plant-Based Chico Facebook group. And that is about all I have for the calendar. If you have an event to share, send me an email at chicovegan@gmail.com. And we have one last bit of business to take care of, and that is the animal rights quote of the week. Take it away, Danny.
Our animal rights quote of the week is from E.B. White, author of Charlotte's Web, The Elements of Style, which I'm still trying to practice, and many captivating essays on modern life. Quote, "A farm is a peculiar problem for a man who likes animals, because the fate of most livestock is that they are murdered by their benefactors." Non-Human Radio is made possible through the generous contributions of KZFR listeners like you.
This has been Non-Human Radio, a production of KZFR 90.1 FM Chico. The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are those of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of KZFR, its board, its volunteers, or its staff.
We do, however, reflect the opinions of our non-human fellow earthlings who'd rather not be killed and eaten, farmed, hunted, raced, experimented upon, poached, have their horns cut off, be drowned in plastic nets, and or otherwise abused.